welcome today to the Grow Young Project. My name's Rod Francis. And today I have an interview for you. It's with a gentleman by the name of Michael Myersco, and Michael is one of our leading experts from the Grow Young Project, and his area is in relationship health and well-being. Michael is a director of a company called The Relationship Gym and is a leading relationship coach and therapist, and has appeared in magazines and television across the world. And relationship health and well-being is clearly one of the pillars of the Grow Young Project. So without any further ado, let's go and listen to what Michael and I had to say. First question is, what are the three biggest reasons for relationship breakdown in your opinion?
Okay, so the three biggest are funny. The biggest presenting problem is generally that people's sex life is tanked and they're unhappy with the level of intimacy and how that's going between the two of them. But that's just a symptom. So in truth, that should be number three, not number one. Mm. And number one for me, and this is specific to the work that I do, is that they should never got married. So some people just make very bad choices about who they marry, and they end up in an unworkable relationship, and then eventually they separate. Mm. You know, so that I'd say is number one. You know, I often sit down with people, and I look at them, and I just go, you know, the biggest problem with your marriage is the fact you got married.
Mm.
Because there is a such thing as, you know, incompatibility.
Mm.
You know, so what's interesting about that is that many years ago, I started the relationship gym, and we were working with marriages, and then it became obvious that actually the fact they got married was an issue. You know, I found
right.
some research, and so I went back and started working on a program called Finding Mr. Right, which is about people specifically engineering the kind of relationships that will really work for them in the long term, and that includes things like, you know, compatible attachment styles, which is phenomenally important. You know, if you get somebody who's chronically avoidant with somebody who's chronically anxious about attachment, then the person that's chronically anxious is just going to be having a fairly painful time of it, and the person that's chronically avoidant is going to be finding them largely irritating.
Mm.
So that's one example of a tricky dynamic. But there are tons of them in terms of incompatibility that people build into their relationships. Like they'll marry a person that is never, ever going to meet their needs because that person's no interest. And you can't change people. Mm. You know, as hard as you try, it's very unlikely.
Yeah.
Now, if they've got kids, well, at that point it's a little bit different because there's leverage and potentially somebody will change.
Mm.
You know, but you need a ton of leverage to get somebody to change and to become, you know, if we're going to talk about a guy as the most obvious example, like guys don't like talking about their feelings and they will maintain, this is a generalization, they'll maintain that they can't do it, it's just not their thing, they don't want to do it. And if I go, well, look, buddy, it's exactly that attitude that's going to cost you your marriage and your kids, you might want to reconsider.
Mm.
Well, bizarrely, empathy can be taught, and he will learn. Mm. But the first point is he has to be motivated and he has to want to. So, okay, so
yes.
So my first piece in terms of how marriages end up falling apart is that just incompatibility, you know?
Right.
And that one... Not a lot of work to be done on that. And one of the things specific about the work that I learned with Terence Real is I'm allowed to take a position on that.
Right.
I'm allowed to go, actually, it's unlikely this will work. If you want to give it a go, we can, but let me show you what's going on here.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, the second biggest reason people break up is they have absolutely no process for clearing resentment, you know, or for handling conflict.
Right.
Okay, and I'd say that that's your biggest reason. You
right.
know, the incompatibility thing, that's just unfortunate, you know. But it's the fact that none of us are trained how to handle being in an intimate relationship.
Mm.
Being in an intimate relationship with somebody and living with them, there is no way it's not going to get painful and difficult at points. I very rarely hear from people who never argue or never fall out. And the problem for a lot of us is that we equate arguing and falling out with each other is there being something wrong with the relationship, and that's not necessarily true.
Mm.
What's wrong is that each of you as individuals haven't really figured out how to show up in a way that allows you to process and clear resentment. And, and if you can't clear resentment, it's very, very difficult to talk about things that could well be fairly small issues, you know, in terms of, you know, he never... he never clears up after dinner, or she's always out with her friends. You know, these things aren't insurmountable.
Mm.
But they are if you've got a ton of resentment, so that every time you start trying to have an argument, you have this kind of what I call historical rage come up.
Mm. Yeah.
Which, you know, could be about you and your partner, but truthfully, also, more often than not, it's about, you know, them and their parents.
Mm.
You know, so stuff that hasn't been cleared from childhood.
Mm.
I mean, it amazes me that we only have a 50% divorce rate, you know.
Mm.
I look at it and I just go, how is this ever going to work?
Mm.
And yeah. I think there's an awful lot of people just gritting their teeth and just getting through it.
Yeah. So this kind of opens up really great topic, because the next question I wanted to know about each of these three areas that you've outlined, which were compatibility right from the beginning, this
yep.
area around conflict and how we resentment and so forth, and then the other area you nominated, which was about sex and sexuality. So what can we do about these areas? You know, can you go through those one at a time, what we might be able to do about them?
Well, the first one that I spoke about around compatibility, I'd say... Generally, we don't get together accidentally. You know, I'm listening to quite a few of my colleagues. That people hook up and get together for a reason. You know, and at least at some point in the past, there was attraction and there was connection. And more often than not, even with people who feel like they just should never have got together,
mm-hmm.
we can get through it.
Mm.
But bizarrely, as a therapeutic tool, it's often quite useful for them to know that actually it's not compulsory. You know,
mm.
it may turn out that they're just not compatible, and that's all right.
Yeah.
You know, no fault of their own. Unless, of course, kids are involved, in which case it just becomes very, very difficult in terms of disentangling that. I'm a long way from pro-divorce, you know, but even if their relationship isn't brilliant, if you're taking on a family, you know, your life only gets worse and harder if you split. You know,
right.
And the easiest example of that is if you split, you're supporting two households on exactly the same income.
Mm.
You know? And most people step back and go, oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Mm.
You know, and divorce is so hypothetical anyway, because if you've got kids, you go, well, you know, we'll just be dealing with each other till the kids grow up. But that's not true, because you'll be dealing with each other till the grandkids grow up.
Mm.
You know, you'll always be in contact anyway. So my money's on... excuse me. My money's on fixing the relationship.
Right.
Because, you know, they're going to be in your life for life. You know, fundamentally, I'm very big on the idea that people don't get married too early.
Mm.
You know, if you could take the time to sit down and work out whether you're actually compatible, that's why, bizarrely, you know, that churches offer some fantastic little courses for working out whether or not people should get married.
Mm.
And give them some tips and some hints in terms of, you know, how to deal with it. And I remember when we got married, the bishop said, listen, you know, there are going to be challenges, and it's really important you stick with it and you push through it. And, you know, even, you know, myself, trained as a professional, I can still reflect back on that from time to time. I think, you know, it's important.
Mm.
And again, so fundamentally what I'd like to see everybody do before they get married is look at their compatibility. And that's a very real process of just sitting down and working out what are your core emotional needs.
Mm.
You know, what do you need to feel loved and safe in the longer term in a relationship?
Mm.
And is the person you think about marrying ever going to be able to supply that?
Yeah.
Because in this day and age, our expectations are very, very high of our relationships. You know, we
mm.
don't just want somebody who's a teammate in terms of raising the kids.
Mm.
We want a perpetual love affair. And that is an awful lot to ask of two people,
mm.
you know, or of one partner in your life.
Yeah.
But it's an expectation. And if you're smart, it's possible.
Mm. So that's wonderful on the area of compatibility in the beginning. What about this area of communication and resentment? What things can be done to prevent that?
All right. So communication and resentment is quite brilliant, and it's not obvious how you work with it. Anybody selling you relationship coaching on the basis I'm going to teach you communication skills and conflict resolution is wasting their time, and they're wasting your time, in my opinion.
Mm.
And there's a lot of fairly old models around marriage counseling that do that.
Mm.
What some people fail to understand is that deep within every one of us, there's a piece of us that just isn't interested. You know, and we can talk about that in terms of being the adapted child. But it's a very real piece that is only concerned with our own survival. So every time conflict occurs, that piece kicks up and acts in a very specific way.
Mm.
And the classic example that I share with clients that's easiest is that, you know, when Mary starts to feel upset or like, you know, Bob isn't paying her enough attention, she starts to kind of get in his face a little bit, like, what's the matter? Why don't you talk to me? And Bob, who resents Mary, kind of Mary's intrusion, withdraws a little bit further, at which point Mary gets a little bit more insistent, and Bob backs off a little bit more. And the end of this story is, you know, Bob jumps up from the table, storms out of the room, slamming the door, and Mary ends up in a fit of tears. Mm. And now that's a fairly generalized picture, but most of the couples I work with get that, because that is, it's not unusual.
Mm.
So the issue there isn't so much that they don't have communication skills, they don't have conflict resolution skills, it's that there's a piece of them inside that's stuck in a model of survival.
Right.
And it gets in the way. So what will generally happen is I'll teach people, you know, what you'd call your the more. So the more Mary gets loud, the more Bob retreats.
Mm.
Okay. And that's the foundation for what you could call a 40-year argument. People will have the same argument over and over about different things, but they'll do it in exactly the same way. And it's freakishly obvious when you break it down with people.
Mm.
And you go, okay, so every time you go here and she goes there, okay, stop it.
Yeah.
And I kid you not, it's as simple as stopping doing what you always do, because it just kills the dynamic outright. The problem is nobody can do it, because they come back and they go, okay, we tried to do that, but I couldn't because I got resentful or I got afraid or whatever it is. So the second layer is working on the piece of you that isn't willing to do the work.
Mm.
And that's the bit that an awful lot of therapists will miss, because they don't understand the deeper dynamics of what goes on. It's not as simple as saying, just close your mouth and count to 10.
Mm.
And for whatever reason, some therapists believe it is. And maybe they're wired differently than I am, you know.
Mm.
But it doesn't work.
Mm. So what does work? Does it help sometimes when they're in those moments of conflict to take a step back, to take a moment, to take a breath?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so my biggest tool, and this just sounds insulting to the intelligence, is a timeout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we look at it with kids, and it works with kids, and then you go, I'm not a child. And it's like, actually, when you're in that state, you are a child.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest thing to do is to grow yourself up.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to take responsibility. And frankly, either you shut your own mouth or your partner tells you to shut your mouth in the nicest way possible. So the mechanism that I teach and I've been taught that really works is just a very simple timeout.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is, you know, when what you or your partner spots, the things are getting a little out of control and a little heated and you're off into your 40-year argument, you just turn around and you go, timeout.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing is that that's done in a neutral tone to the best of your ability, because time out, you idiot, you know. Here you go again, you moron, time out.
Yeah.
That's offensive and it's combative. Mm. It doesn't work.
Mm.
But time out, I was taught, and again, a lot of my work comes from Terence Real, but I was taught by Terence that time out is shorthand for love of my life. I recognize that sometime in the next few seconds or minutes, things are probably going to get out of control between the two of us, and I love you enough to stop that.
Mm.
Okay, and if both of you can hear that when they say time out, then life's easier. But between you and I, nobody enjoys being timed out. You know, it's always perceived as an insult. It's always perceived as painful and as some kind of, you know, some kind of offensive act. But the reality is that an hour later, you'll go, wow, I'm really glad we timed that out, because now I'm not having to clear up the mess of getting angry. So you have the initial issue, which is, Bob, I'd like you to wash up. And Bob going, well, then you come back and then in an hour's time, you just have a conversation about the washing up. You don't have to have a conversation about how the fact that you started throwing pots and pans around at each other in the kitchen.
Mm. Yeah.
And timeouts just mean there's nothing else to clear. Like, from the moment you master a timeout, you do not have to clear up any of the nonsense where you've just gone irresponsible, you know, where you've got really aggressive or you've got really nasty or, you know, there are five relationship crimes that they talk about, you know. Needing to be right, trying to control your partner, unbridled self-expression, retaliation, and walling off.
Right.
You know. And unbridled self-expression is massive in some couples. Mm. And it's never helpful, and you always have to come back and apologize and sort that out. And the other one about needing to be right is also a real problem, because most of us need to be right. And the thing is, that's tempting about that is 50% of the time you will be right. So it always feels like worth having a go, but it's just pointless, because if you look at it as a relationship, you both exist in this ecosphere together. It's very delicate. And if you're in that ecosphere and your partner's feeling like they're wrong, then there's a particular smell to that, and you're breathing it in anyway.
Yeah. You know?
There's nothing to be gained by being right. And my favorite tool is timeouts. I think it's enormous. But you have to understand what they mean and why you're doing them, and both people have to be on board. Otherwise, it can become a mechanism, just for antagonizing somebody.
Yeah.
Can I just give you one caveat?
Yeah.
The only problem with timeouts with a particularly avoidant male or a particularly avoidant woman is that they can be used as a way of further avoiding any kind of conflict.
Right.
And the important thing about, sorry, not conflict, any further conversation. And the important thing about timing out is the commitment on behalf of the person that timed out that they will time in again and come back and have the conversation.
Right. So setting a clear time to come back to the conversation as an adult is as important as the timeout.
Yeah, except that's a bit of a luxury, because the idea that we're always going to be able to come out after 20 minutes or an hour or 2 hours.
Yeah.
Some things take a day to clear.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And the guide is that basically if you come back and you're trying to talk about it and you realize you're getting hot again, just give it up for 24 hours.
Okay.
Because you're not able to talk about it. And frankly, there are some conversations I tell my couples not to have unless they've got a grown-up in the room with them.
Yep. Okay. You know?
There's some things that are just too hot to talk about.
Yeah. So listen, I'd really like to hear more now about the third, which was the area of sex and sexuality that you said might actually be one of the main things people bring. So what can be done to prevent that?
Okay, well, look, again, and this is delicate, there's two different ways in which this is an issue. One is angry people don't like having sex with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless they're a little twisted and that's entirely different. You know, that whole kind of makeup sex. I mean, that's okay every once in a while, but it doesn't really work in the longer term. Mm-hmm. Like, people want loving, intimate, safe relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what everybody wants. They want to feel safe. They want to feel loved. It's very simple. If you've got a ton of resentment, you can't do that. And, and the symptom of that is that your intimacy starts to die away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people show up on my couch, you know, not having had sex, not having sex, not wanting sex, or, you know, one party's not interested and the other one's just feeling bereft. And, you know, what's funny about that is people hear it as a criticism of each other, and generally it's a request for reassurance. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff around attachment theory, and Sue Johnson did some brilliant work with this in terms of moving it from it just being about infants to it being about grown-ups too, and how we come into a relationship as adults and we want to be able to attach. We want to feel loved. We want to feel safe. We want to be able to look towards our partner for reassurance. We want to be able to think about them when we're apart and for that to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And somehow, that's not always possible. You know, when you get resentful and stuff. And sex plays a really important role in people bonding. And you know, bizarrely, I've heard this said before. Barbara DeAngelis used to say that, you know, if you think about sex and how it works, it's awfully close to, you know, the kind of the sounds of, okay, I don't know whether I want this on record or not, but there's a connection with parenting. There's something about that warmth and that comfort and that amount of love and that amount of connection. And there's something not so dissimilar from, I think her example was breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always stuck in my mind that it's important for people to be able to go to that place. Now, that's in terms of the warmth and the love and the reassurance and the attachment and, you know, do you love me? I love you, you know, and that connection, you know, will you be here for me?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's kind of the romantic side of love, and that's amazing and brilliant. And one of the things I used to get asked in the beginning of my work with couples, well, I mean, I still get asked, it's just my answers change. Is it possible to keep that hot passion alive right through a marriage? And I used to just go, yes, because I assumed it was. And, having done research, both personally and professionally, it's become clear to me that it's much trickier than people might believe. And who really helped me with this was a woman called Esther Perel, who teamed up with Terence Real, which is how I came into contact with her.
Mm.
And she just pointed to something obvious in terms of, you know, there's a certain, you know, if the verb around romantic love, you know, it's to have, you know, I have you, are you here for me, you know, that's one particular flavor. But the verb around desire is to want. And fundamentally, it gets very hard to want what you've already had or what you have. You know, so you know, respectfully, it's very hard to get very turned on and really aroused about doing something for the 100th time. Or maybe not the first 100, but let's talk about the first 1,000. Eventually, it gets very obvious which direction it's going in, and that can get a little dull. So it's not that the love has died between a couple, but a piece of them's concerned that the passion's gone. So with people, I very rarely ask them, you know, what's your sex life like? Because that's not interesting. Most people might have sex 2 or 3 times a month, and they're kind of okay with that. But if I was to ask them, what's the quality of your erotic life? That's an entirely different question. And people have very different responses. So my thing used to be, you know, when was the last time you had great sex? You know, not just good sex, but great sex. And for some people, it's years, you know? Or they'll go, you know what, I can't even remember the time I had good sex. And in a relationship, as much as that, you know, there's comedy value there somewhere, but the reality is that's excruciating. Because sex is one of the places as grown-ups we get to play, you know? For a lot of men, it's one of the only places we get to play, you know? It's like our lives can be very dry, you know, all about achievement, all about success, but there's not a lot of juice in that. Whereas when we come back to the bedroom with our wives or girlfriends, it reanimates a piece of us. So it's fundamentally really important. The big point is there's a major difference between to have and to want. And when wanting goes, you've got a significant problem.
That's absolutely brilliant and really kind of fundamental. I like that. What I'd like to just move on to now is just a really important question, which is there's clearly times when it's best to separate. And when might that be, in your opinion?
Okay, so I know a lot of therapists draw a line around physical violence. And they go, the moment physical violence occurs, it's best to separate. But it's like if you've really tried, you know, if you've actually gone to a professional of some kind of level of competence, and frankly, there's a lot of incompetence around marriage counseling and marriage coaching, because, you know, people are stuck in a very old model, you know, and this was distressing to me. I started marriage counseling, and the joke within my colleagues and peers was that all you're really doing is allowing them to separate elegantly. I was like, well, that's not enough. You know, I watched my parents divorce, and I know the impact that had on my life, and it caused me a huge amount of pain. And I didn't want to just be party to that. It's ridiculous. So I went off and got trained in the States with a model that actually really works, you know. So Terrence's work is brilliant, and I also think that anybody who's had anything to do with Sue Johnson understands adult attachment theory is very, very good. Anybody who's worked with Harville Hendricks and understands the whole thing around imago and how we're attracted to people, it's not accidental, is also very good. And anybody who's worked with John Gottman, you know, there's 4 people, incredible influences that are pro-marriage. And it's rare. You know, bizarrely, you can have marriage therapists that aren't particularly pro-marriage. Now, there does come a point at which you just cannot get it together. If you've managed to engage with a decent marriage therapist and you're still stuck and you're still at a point where one or both of you is just completely dissatisfied, then it may well be time to say goodbye. You know, a good example would be, let's say you've got an untreated, depressed adult who refuses to take medication or to get therapy. Well, you know, being on the other end of that, it's not your fault. There's a fantasy that somehow marriage breakdown is always a 50-50 deal. It isn't. It's one of the biggest pieces of misinformation. If you've got somebody that's fundamentally untreated, like you've got somebody who's, a radical narcissist, and life is all about them, and their needs, and what they want, and what they desire, and you rarely feature, well, that's time to say goodbye. You know, if you're living with a borderline personality disorder and they refuse to get treated, well, I might look at that and go, this isn't going to work. You know, so, you know, it'll become obvious. It's about the level of dissatisfaction. You know, if you're mildly pissed off at each other, you know, and you're kind of at a 5 and it just feels like a grind, well, there's probably work to be done. But if you're up to 10 and you get to see a marriage therapist or get some help, then and it's still not clearing, then you know there's a significant problem. And I just point to incompatibility and say, it's time to say goodbye. Yeah. Now, as disappointing as that is and as embarrassing as it may be, it's going to be worth it in the long run. If you think about it, you know, I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that most of us are going to live to 100. You know, unless they get unlucky with cancer. And that's a lot of years to be having dinner with somebody and to be bored to death or resentful.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of years to be managing that low level of dissatisfaction. My thing is, life's very short. You know, it's very, very short. It's a grand adventure. And if I'm in a relationship with somebody that just feels irksome, and I've tried fixing it, and I've done everything I can, it's time to say goodbye. Okay, just one other thing. Did you present any kind of a solution to the issues around sex and intimacy?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, I'd highly recommend people take a look at Mating in Captivity by Esther Perel, because it's quite brilliant. And her fundamental concept is the idea that a lot of us take each other for granted, and we assume we're safe, and that that person has no eyes for any other. And she talks about how if you start being honest, you can bring in the concept that actually, you know, we have our own erotic lives. You know, internally, we have our own kind of references for what gets us hot and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we don't share that stuff because we're embarrassed about it or we're ashamed about it. And there's a massive wealth of material inside of us that will rekindle desire if we're able to be a little more honest. Now, that doesn't mean you have to disclose everything, because that can kill some of our own erotic life.
Yeah.
But you can certainly share a lot more than most people do. And that is quite brilliant in terms of how it can reinvigorate that sense of passion and desire between the two of you. Because we take each other for granted and we think we know the other, but when we start being really honest, it becomes clear we really don't. And that's when it gets exciting again.
Yeah.
And that's an incredible and life-changing piece of work for a couple to do.
Mm.